So as I was trying to prepare for this sermon this morning, I got stuck. Even though I've got a list of possible topics, I just felt like I didn't have time to do one of those, and I just could not come up with anything. So I'm not going to say anything. So anyway, Becky said, "Well, why don't you talk about this? Because here's something we've been talking to Thomas about recently." And I thought, okay. Yeah, that's good. And even sitting here this morning, I thought, I don't really have much of a fun introduction, which it's something to try to, you know, get somebody's attention, but also bring us into the topic. And yet again, she told me something. She probably had no idea it was going to relate to this. And it's a local story, local news story. I had not heard it. She said, "Hey, did you hear about what happened at the Roane County Courthouse last week?" Tara clearly has, because she lives over there. I had not. I said, "What happened?" So apparently somebody came in, I assume he had a case there, and he had bed bugs. And like they saw him crawling on the walls next to where the guy was standing. And it was so bad, they just shut down court for the whole day. And I did look at a news article, and one of the judges said, "In all my years as an assistant DA and a judge and so on, I've never seen this happen." And they had 40-some cases on the criminal court docket where this guy was that day. So they had a packed day. It was so bad, they shut down court and going to reset all those people. So if you need any more evidence that bad company corrupts good morals, don't hang out with somebody with bed bugs, okay? That's where we're going to go today, is 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33. It's a pretty straightforward, self-explanatory passage. Yet it's something that we all need to hear from time to time. Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. And depending on your version, you might have a slightly different reading. Evil company, evil companions, bad company, you may say corrupts or ruins, good morals, good habits, all those things. What do we get from that? It's basically that if you've got a good person, let's simplify it, a good person and a bad person, and they're hanging out for any extended period of time, one's going to influence the other. And more often than not, it's going to be the evil companion that's going to negatively influence the good one. And the Bible's full of examples of this. So we'll look at some of those this morning. Let's start in the book of Exodus chapter 34, starting with verse 12. Exodus 34, starting with verse 12. This is instructions to the nation of Israel. "Take care not to make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you are going, or it will become a snare among you. You shall tear down their altars, break their pillars, and cut down their sacred poles," which, going back to the last sermon I had a couple of weeks ago, that's the Asherah. "For you shall worship no other god, because the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. You shall not make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, for when they prostitute themselves to their gods and sacrifice to their gods, someone among them will invite you, and you will eat of the sacrifice. And you will take wives from among their daughters for your sons, and their daughters who prostitute themselves to their gods will make your sons also prostitute themselves to their gods." It's a pretty explicit command. When you go in to take the land, don't make any covenants with these people, no treaties. In fact, what were they supposed to do? The command was to utterly drive them out, right? Well, what happens? Let's turn over to Judges. Judges chapter 1, starting with verse 27. "Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, or Tanakh and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Iblim and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, but the Canaanites continued to live in that land. When Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not in fact drive them out. So there's a bunch of villages that they didn't fully execute the command of God. But hey, they did get some slave labor out of it. Maybe that's something, right? But what was the end result? Let's keep going. Verse 29. And Ephraim, so it wasn't just Manasseh. This is a pretty widespread problem. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer, but the Canaanites lived among them in Gezer. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Naalal, but the Canaanites lived among them and became subject to forced labor. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko or the inhabitants of Sidon or of Alab or of Achzib or of Helba or of Aphek or of Rehob, but the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and of Beth Anath became subject to forced labor for them. The Amorites pressed the Danites back into the hill country. They did not allow them to come down to the plain. The Amorites continued to live in Har-Hiris, in Aijalon, and in Shalbim, but the hand of the house of Joseph rested heavily on them, and they became subject to forced labor. The border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah and upward. Do we need to read all those names? Well, it was fun, right, Larry? You're saying, where's Nathan? He could pronounce those better than I can. But it just goes to show that tribe after tribe after tribe all failed to do what they were supposed to do, which was drive out all these people. And some of them, they probably justified their actions. Well, this city's going to be too hard to take. Or we could really use some slave labor, so let's just leave some of these people here and we'll use them for our own purposes. What's the end result? Let's look at Judges chapter 2, starting with verse 11. And this really summarizes the entire book of Judges, starting with verse 11 of chapter 2. Then the Israelites did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and worshipped the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were all around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and worshipped Baal and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the power of their enemies all around, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them to bring misfortune, as the Lord had warned them and sworn to them, and they were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges, who delivered them out of the power of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen even to their judges, for they lusted after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their ancestors had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord. They did not follow their example. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord would be moved to pity by their groaning because of those who persecuted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they would relapse and behave worse than their ancestors, following other gods, worshiping them, and bowing down to them. They would not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. And time after time after time again, they get oppressed. They fall away. A judge comes into power and rescues them, frees them from whatever oppression it is, and they serve God for a short period of time. Then they fall away again. And one of the primary reasons for this, as it tells us in Judges chapter 1, they did not follow the command of the Lord to drive all these idol-worshipping heathens out of the land. Why was that important? Because bad company corrupts good morals. Having these people around exerted some amount of influence upon them. What do we know when by the end of Judges, or when we get to Samuel? That the people wanted a king. Why would they want a king? Because they wanted to be like all these other people around them that they hadn't driven out. And it just, it didn't work out. This is a good example of, well, peer pressure, of wanting to fit in. Hey, well, you know, our neighbors are worshiping this idol. You know, we don't want to be perceived as goofy to them. We want to have a good relationship with our neighbors, so yeah, we can worship this idol too. And it just doesn't go well for the nation of Israel. And they have this this back and forth conflict throughout Judges, into Samuel, into the time with the kings. Let's turn over to 1 Kings 11. We'll hit our next example. 1 Kings chapter 11, we have the downfall of Solomon. From 1 Kings chapter 1 up through verse 10, or through 1 Kings chapter 1 through 10, Solomon is held up as someone who was good, who followed after his father David, following God. Solomon built the temple. When he had the opportunity to request anything of the Lord, he made a wise choice and asked for wisdom. And it looked like he was trying to do what was right in the sight of the Lord. What happened with Solomon in chapter 11? Let's look, starting with verse 1. King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the Israelites, "You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for they will surely incline your heart to follow their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. Among his wives were 700 princesses and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon followed Astarte, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not completely follow the Lord as his father David had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who offered incense and sacrifice to their gods. Then the Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and had commanded him concerning this matter that he should not follow other gods. But he did not observe what the Lord commanded. Again, what had Solomon done in the chapters prior to chapter 11? He had built the temple, this great structure, so that the people could worship Jehovah, the God that had delivered them from Egypt, that had bestowed such wisdom upon Solomon. And it seems as if he got to the point where, well, he's married all these women from all these other countries. Well, I'll still worship the God that I'm supposed to, but all my wives, they still want to worship the gods of their lands. So let's, yeah, we can build a temple here and erect an altar here, and so on. That's not pleasing to God. And that was clear. What was it that corrupted Solomon's heart? It was these close relationships with these women and concubines. Perhaps some of them were not as close as what we think of as husband and wife today. I mean, how can you be if you've got 700 wives? I don't know. My guess is that some of these were political marriages. They were married in name only, but he didn't have much of a relationship with some of these. Regardless, the text here tells us what happened. And these women, what does it say? Verse 2, Solomon clung to these in love. And his wives, in verse 3, turned away his heart. Whether it was political alliances or poor choices in marriage, bad company corrupted his good morals. One other example from the Old Testament that we'll look at is King Jehoshaphat. Let's look first in 1 Kings chapter 22. 1 Kings 22, verse 41. Jehoshaphat, son of Asa, began to reign over Judah in the fourth year of King Ahab of Israel. Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 25 years in Jerusalem. Verse 43, he walked in all the way of his father Asa. He did not turn aside from it, doing what was right in the sight of the Lord. Yet the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and offered incense on the high places. Is that a contradiction in that sentence? It says that Jehoshaphat himself followed after his father, who was a good king, doing what was right in the sight of the Lord. Yet, there was still idol worship going on within his kingdom. And he did not tear these high places down. The people still sacrificed and offered incense to other gods, to idols here. And he didn't stop that. He didn't cancel that within his kingdom, which would have been within his power to do. What else do we know about Jehoshaphat? Well, it told us what we just read in verse 41. The time in which he reigned coincided with Ahab, king of Israel. Would Ahab have been a good companion or an evil companion? Clearly, we know the answer to that. And Jehoshaphat did form at least some type of an alliance with Ahab. Let's look at 2 Chronicles chapter 19. This is right after Ahab is killed in battle, where Jehoshaphat has gone into battle with Ahab. Israel and Judah teaming up in battle. And in fact, because a prophet had prophesied that Ahab was going to die in this battle, they dressed up Jehoshaphat like he's the king of Israel. And Ahab was not dressed as a king. Now, why would Jehoshaphat go for this? It doesn't make any sense to me. Hey, I've gotten this prophecy that I'm going to be killed in battle. Would you mind dressing up as the king and leading my army into battle? Sure, that sounds like a great idea to me, Ahab. Let me do that. Regardless, that's what happens. But still, the prophecy comes true. You've got someone who just draws a bow and shoots an arrow blindly into the air, and lo and behold, bam, it gets Ahab, right? So Ahab has died at the end of chapter 18. We get into chapter 19, and look what we see. Chapter 19 of 2 Chronicles, verse 2. Jehu, son of Hanani the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Because of this, wrath has gone out against you from the Lord. Nevertheless, some good is found in you, for you destroyed the sacred poles out of the land and have set your heart to seek God." So here again, we've got this mixed message about Jehoshaphat, similar to what we saw in Kings, where he did do some good, but he didn't do everything he should have done. And here, the judgment that's pronounced against Jehoshaphat is, why are you helping the wicked, i.e. Ahab? And why are you helping those who hate the Lord, loving those who hate the Lord? At least Jehoshaphat could have been far worse. We'll give him some amount of credit here, because the scripture does, that it says some good is found in him, that the prophet does say that he's set his heart to seek God. But clearly this alliance with Ahab did not do him any favors. So what can we make from this and these Old Testament examples? Well, if Paul, writing in 1 Corinthians, is still telling us that bad company corrupts good morals, it's still something that is a life lesson centuries after these stories that we just read. Let's look also at James chapter 4. James chapter 4. And verse 4, "Adulterers, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God." That's pretty clear. We can't be friends with the world and be a Christian and love the Lord. Paul also writes in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. The last part of that chapter, there's a pretty lengthy list of sinful people, things that we should not be doing ourselves, things that we should not be affiliated with. In Romans 1 and verse 32, they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die. What else does Paul write, though? Yet, they not only do them, but even applaud others who practice them. This one reads a little bit differently. Most versions are going to, or at least the ones you're probably looking at, King James, New King James, they're going to say those who approve of those who practice them. Oh, I'm not doing it myself, but so-and-so over here is doing that, and whatever he wants to do is fine with me. That's friendship with the world. That's being an enemy of God. And what Paul tells us in this passage here is that even though we may not be practicing them, if we're applauding those who do or approving of those, then we're just as guilty. So what's the application for us then? Clearly, there are dangers in being too close with the world or with evil influences, bad friends. And just as we saw, you know, in Solomon, and Solomon was just the best example from the nation of Israel of intermarriage with people that were not following God. That's a very important decision, whom we choose to marry, and what kind of heart that person has can have a tremendous influence on ourselves. Not just the spouse, but also friends, business partners, other family members, anyone that we're closely associated with can have a tremendous influence upon us. And it's not just individuals that we know. It can be people that we're quote-unquote fans of. It can be, you know, whatever we're consuming via television, via reading, whatever. Whatever we're spending our time occupying our minds with can be enmity with God because we're friends with the world. It can be allowing evil companions to corrupt our good morals. Let's look at 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, starting with verse 12. There is no restriction in our affections, but only in yours. In return, I speak as to children, open wide your hearts also. Do not be mismatched with unbelievers. We're more accustomed to hearing that as not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what partnership is there between righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship is there between light and darkness? What agreement does Christ have with Belial? Or what does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? Most often we hear this passage discussed in the context of marriage, of a Christian being married to someone who's not a Christian. And that certainly applies. I think it's much broader than that. As we see the questions that Paul asks in here, what agreement does, you know, what partnership is there between righteousness and lawlessness? Again, it can be any friend. Any influence has the potential to draw us away. What are the objections that we hear to this type of lesson, though? We'll hear questions like, well, can't we be good influences on the lost? In fact, don't we have a duty to do that? Well, sure. Let's look at Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9, starting with verse 9. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. And as he sat at dinner in the house, many tax collectors and sinners came and were sitting with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with the tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard this, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners." See, Jesus hung out with sinners. So shouldn't we do that too? Well, when he did, what was the context? Was he just partying it up with them in their revelry? Was he participating in whatever sin these tax collectors and sinners were doing? No. He was spending time with them, showing that they were important, that God was interested in their souls and trying to teach them. Look at Matthew chapter 28, our Great Commission. Matthew 28, starting with 18. Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you." Again, we've got to go out and interact with people. We can't just become hermits up on a mountain, never dealing with society. That's not what God calls us to do. But what is the commission? It's to go and make disciples of all nations, teaching them, baptizing them. It's not go join them in their sinful practices or go and just be social friends, afraid to teach, afraid to mention God, and falling victim to whatever their evil influences may be. Let's look back again at 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33. We focus often on the bad company corrupts good morals portion of that verse. But what's the first part of it? Do not be deceived. Because if we deceive ourselves thinking good company can corrupt bad morals, that's not what it says. But sometimes we may deceive ourselves thinking that's what it is. Let's look at Luke chapter 15. Luke chapter 15, again, as we're talking about the tax collectors and sinners, Jesus meeting with them. Luke 15, verse 1, "Now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him. And the Pharisees and scribes were grumbling and saying, 'This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" Let's listen to the parable that Jesus tells. He tells them this parable. "Which one of you, having 100 sheep and losing one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders and rejoices. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost.' Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous with no need to repent." What does the shepherd do? Does he go out hunting the one? Hunting. That's a bad... He's not really hunting. Go out searching for the one. And when he finds the one, "Oh, hey, you're over here with a bunch of wolves. These wolves don't look that bad. Let's hang out with the wolves for a while. Let's lie down with the wolves and take a nap." No, as soon as he finds the one, let's get out of there and get back to the safety of with the others, whether that's in the fold or at least with the group. The shepherd didn't stay out there. He went and he did the job. He found the one that had strayed, and they returned. We were talking about it in the adult class this morning in Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 6, Paul tells us about the put on the whole armor of God. And when do we need that armor? Let's turn over there. Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 11, "Put on the whole armor of God so that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." We don't know when those things are coming, but if we're around evil influences, they're going to be coming a lot more. And that's when we need this armor. Why? Is there an armor of Satan to defend the sinners against the wiles of the Christians? That's not what it says. We need this armor because bad company can corrupt good morals. The last verse that we'll look at is from John chapter 15. John chapter 15, starting with verse 14. You are my friends if you do what I command you. I do not call you servants any longer, because the servant does not know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, because I have made known to you everything that I have heard from my Father." Who do we want our friends to be? Do we want Jesus to be our friend? Yeah. And how do we do that? Jesus tells us, "You are my friends if you do what I command you." And the way that we do that is to listen to him, to study our Bibles, to understand what Jesus wants us to do. And once we obey, we're going to be following a different path from the world. And we can't serve two masters. Yeah, we need to be around sinners in order to have interaction, in order to be able to teach and preach. But we don't need to make them our closest companions, because that's only going to ruin our own good habits or good morals. It's going to draw us away, just like it did the nation of Israel, just like it did Solomon. Friendship with the world is enmity with God. How about you? Are you a friend of Jesus today? If so, that means that you're doing what Jesus has commanded us. And if you need to make him your friend, then the way to do that is not on our terms. We're not making Jesus our friend based on how we define friendship or what we want our friends to be. Jesus has laid that down. You are my friends if you do what I command you. If you have a need to respond to the invitation to become a friend of Jesus, make that need known. You can confess your faith in Jesus. You can be baptized today. Or if you need to renew your friendship with Jesus because maybe you've been drawn away by evil companions and you need to make things right, you have that opportunity this morning while we stand and sing number 840.